Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Random Heathen Ramblings podcast, where we discuss all sorts of things Germanic heathenry related. My name is Jesse, and I am your host. Let's get into it.
Gjallveitir Workshop is dedicated to the old ways, offering a wide selection of animist ritual supplies, divination tools, altar goods, and home decor, including premium reindeer hides imported from traditional herders in northern Finland. Whether you're just starting your spiritual journey or looking to expand your collection with a custom drum, we have everything you need. Visit our online store at gjallveitir.com and discover the beauty of mountain spirit.
Welcome back, everybody, to this week's episode of the podcast. Thanks so much for coming back and seeing what we have to ramble on this week about. I'm very excited to introduce our guest this week. He comes from places overseas in Europe somewhere. We're going to find out more about him. He is an author or the author of a book called The Call of the Runes. His name is Walter McGrory, and we're going to be talking with Walter today about that book. What brought him to wanting to write such an extensive book on rune knowledge? I have a copy of it. Actually, I did a review on my YouTube channel, which if you want to watch that particular video, it'll be linked in the show notes of this podcast. And for all you Patreon folks, it'll be linked down below in the description of this video. As a quick reminder, if you are listening to this on the audio platforms and you want to watch what's going on screen, since I have video capabilities and my guests are on video as well, you can do so by becoming a patron on my Patreon for just $1. And you're under no obligation to repeat that every month. If you pledge a dollar and watch a bunch of the videos that I have available, and then you don't want to re-up or renew your subscription or your pledge every month, you don't have to. You can come and go as you please. The door is there. And you're free to navigate however you see fit. So my Patreon information is going to be found in my Linktree link, along with all of my other social media information. So if you want to follow me along on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, subscribe to the YouTube channel, buy some merch. That's always nice because you're supporting me in several ways and you're getting yourself something cool in return. You get to support the brand and, help spread the word, spread the knowledge about what I do. It's all Midgard Musings branded stuff. And that's also linked in my Linktree. So if you go to the description or show notes, find my Linktree information there and scroll down until you find stuff that's of interest to you. All right. As a quick reminder too, in terms of merch, I do just want to say that all the way now through the end of this month on my spring store, on my merch store, there is Sacred Trail Society branded merchandise, which if you buy any merchandise from now until the end of this month, to the end of April, any profits that I earn from the sale of Sacred Trail Society branded merchandise, all that money is being collected and donated to the Nature Conservancy in observation of Earth Day this year. So whatever we can do, I'm not keeping a cent of that. All of the money that gets raised in terms of profits, there's costs to go into the production of the merchandise and shipping it all out. But aside from that, I'm not keeping any of the profits. It's all going to the Nature Conservancy. So if you want to help out the Nature Conservancy and get a shirt or a hoodie or anything else down there, I think there's some coffee cups, some stickers, head over there and buy yours now until the end of April. We're not getting rid of the merchandise after that, but for this month, all of the proceeds, all the profits of those merchandise sales are going to the Nature Conservancy. So I think that pretty much wraps it up for me in terms of housekeeping stuff. Hope you all are doing well this week, and hope you're looking forward to the episode now coming up today with myself and Walter McGroy. We're going to talk about the runes today. And as a lot of you know, the runes are a topic that is very near and dear to my heart. So I'm looking forward to picking Walter's brain, seeing what brought him to this time of his life to write a book about the 24 Elder Futhark runes. So again, if you want to get the book yourself, links for that are going to be down below. Walter also has a YouTube channel, so all of his stuff that you can find him on is going to be linked in the show notes or description video description of this podcast. All right, guys, let's welcome Walter in and see what we can find out about answering the call of the runes. All right, folks, we are joined here with Walter McGroy, who is the author of The Call of the Runes, a book that I have a copy of. Welcome to the show, Walter. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy to talk a little bit about my book and whatever musings we'll come across.
I like that. Yeah, whatever musings we end up getting into, kind of a nod to the namesake of the channel of the show a little bit. I like that. But you are located in, as I understand, you're located in the Netherlands.
Yes.
You've been there your whole life, from the sounds of it. You have.
Yeah, I have the distinct accent of almost speaking English properly, but not quite, which is distinct for most Dutch people. I lived most of my life in the Netherlands. I lived a year or so in China, but besides that, almost all of it was spent in the Netherlands, yes.
Interesting. What brought you to China, if you don't mind me asking? That's quite a jump.
Yeah, it's quite a jump. Well, I'm a religious education teacher by profession. Studied, teacher religious education and interreligious spirituality. Those are the two, the bachelor and the master that I did, so to speak. And after I taught religious education for a while at a school in the Netherlands, and in the Netherlands, religious education is a little bit different than it is in most countries. They call it a learning from the outside perspective. So there is no, it's not a catechism. It's not a, we're teaching you how to be a good Christian, or we're teaching you how to be a good, insert your religion here. But it goes over multiple religions in the world, including Norse paganism, and also goes across multiple philosophers and such things. And after a while, I thought that I'd been studying for a very long time about religious education, but I hadn't really experienced that much of it. So I decided to take 2 years off work and use my savings to do a trip around the world to see all the big pilgrims places in the world. So I walked the Santiago de Compostela, which is a Christian pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. And I went to Rome, obviously, and I went to Turkey extensively. I went to Israel. I went for a very short dip into Egypt, but then that was suddenly civil war, so that didn't really go well. Then I went to India to look at, Hinduism and Buddhism. And I ended up in China for a while, where I stayed at a monastery for about a year.
Wow. So you stayed there at the monastery in China with like monks or whatever.
Taoist monks.
Taoist monks.
Taoist monastery. This and my head was not clean shaven. My hair was much longer than it was then, because the Buddhist monasteries, they shave their heads. The Taoist monasteries, they grow their hair out.
Oh wow! So if you had stayed at a Buddhist temple or monastery, you would have had to adopt the.
Then it was, then yeah. It would have been the other side. Yeah. I must say it wasn't as spectacular. I was there with other foreigners as well, so I feel that it's a little bit like it wasn't as harsh as a regular monastery that you might find higher up on the Wudang Mountain. But yeah.
Wow. That must have been an exciting trip and just the whole experience. How many years did your journeying cover? Like how many years were you going from place to place, and how much time did you spend kind of traveling around and visiting these places?
Yeah, so about 2 years, of which China was the longest bit. China was 10 months, so I say a year was 10 months. I walked from the Netherlands to the Santiago de Compostela. That took me about 3 months. That was also pretty long, and all the other things I did for a month and a half in a place, and then I,
You said you walked from the Netherlands to where? So this, the place you mentioned, is it in what, Portugal or Spain or?
Spain, Spain. Yeah, so that's a 3 month journey.
What did you do along the way? Like, how did you did you go to hotels or like what was your?
I was very ambitious. So for the first say month and a half, 2 months before I reached the more well-traveled part of the route. So one step back, the route to Santiago de Compostela starts at many places. So you find stickers on light posts, so you can follow the road pretty easily. Where I started from my home for the first day or two, I just navigated by compass to roughly go towards where the place, the starting place was. And I brought a little tent. So every night, for most nights, I just looked for a place that was a little bit secluded. And then I pitched my tent. And then I kept walking the next day. And then, once per week, I went into a hotel to, do my laundry and take a shower and those kind of things.
That is ambitious, man. I gotta say, that's why walk it? Like, a 3 month long walk. I'm guessing, like, if we were to calculate that by car or something, that would probably just be a day's drive, maybe.
But, it's like a day by train, maybe 2 hours by airplane. Yeah, that's the curse of long distance travel. I like to walk. I've walked extensively in Scotland as well. And then sometimes you're walking for 5 days and then, you go back like 2 hours, 3 hours with the bus. And it's always a little bit disheartening. Why walk? Well, part of it of that pilgrimage. So I wanted to experience each pilgrimage as it was supposed to be envisioned by the culture that did it. For the Santiago, it is walking. Now, the minimum distance that you have to walk to have it count is 4 days, 100 kilometers. But I went a little bit overzealous there, and I did the whole thing.
Just a little.
Yeah. I did find it very meditative. For me, and we're talking there a little bit about paganism. I don't know if you've ever seen the a statue of Saint Jacob, but if he's across the road, he is this this man with a long beard and that big brimmed head and the walking staff, and he's walking there. And I envisioned that a little bit as an Odin-esque figure that I was traveling the road with. It's a lot of introspection for a few months, but I feel that it was very nice. And would I ever do it in 3 months again? I don't know, but maybe I'll do it again, like just the last bit, the last month from Spain, because as soon as you enter Spain, there's a lot of facilities specifically for the people who do this pilgrimage. So they, there's very cheap hostels and with good food to get you going again, because I ate a lot of beans on a little campfire stove along the way.
Yeah they stick with you, and they're good nutrients to keep you energized and stuff. So it sounds like this pilgrimage is not unpopular. It sounds like they've got the accommodations necessary to help people that want to take that same journey. And I've not gone on quite as long of walks, but I do agree that when you're kind of putting yourself out into nature and walking and just disconnecting a bit from the real world or from the everyday stuff that you deal with, that is very meditative, and it brings you to a headspace where it allows you to think and ponder and, just so many beneficial things about it. I've gone on river walks. I go in the woods, the forest, there's plenty of trails and stuff around here in this state that, you can go on a 10-mile loop and halfway through just be absolutely in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the mountains.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the United States. Like, for the Netherlands, you can have, there's nowhere that you can have that. Like, if you walk 5 kilometers, 4 miles in a straight line, you're hitting a road or some other form of civilization. It's like a very densely populated country. It's that is also something that I really enjoyed because France and, you know, Spain that I went through are much more open countries. To make sure that I had a place to sleep every night, I used to get up very early. So my walking day started at about 4 a.m, especially the last part, because, you know, the closer you get, the more people are on the road, because, as I said, only the last 100 kilometers count, really. Get up at 4, start walking. It's like still somewhat dark. The sun is coming up. You're completely alone on the road for a couple of hours. And then, you know, slowly people start coming in. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, by midday, reach my next little town and set up shop for the last month or so when I was staying at hostels instead of sleeping in my tent.
Do you remember how much distance you covered each day? Was it on an average the same amount, or did you go more or less on some days than others?
On average, it's the same amount. Like, there are some times where it's like, you know, all places are full, so you have to walk farther, or, you know, you walk shorter because you hit a nice town. But generally speaking, and now I'm a little bit struggling with my kilometers to miles conversions, but about 20 to 25 kilometers per day. But that's, you know, it's less than miles, but I don't know what it is. It's about, 4 to 5 hour brisk walk.
Yeah. Yeah.
Each day. I didn't do it in 4 to 5 hours. I did a, you know, 6 to 8 hour meander.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Did you come across any other people doing the same thing?
Oh yeah. It's a very popular walk. Like the first 2 months, not, but, starting, you know, from the very south of France, you meet, you know, dozens of people. And then by the time that you're in Spain, you're like the entire hostel that you're staying is meant only for pilgrims doing the route. And there's like busloads of tourists being flown in.
Oh, wow.
So, gets popular, more popular as you reach the end. So that's why I'm also a little bit happy that I did it the way that I did it.
Yeah, yeah. You had more of your time to yourself for that first stretch. Yeah, that's really impressive, man. Thanks for sharing with us about that. I had no idea that you were such an avid, you know, I say outdoorsman, but like the type of person to just go on those long walks and stuff. Yeah, that's impressive.
It is the longest walk by a magnitude that I've done. I've done several other walks in, like, you know, the UK and through Europe that last about a week. This was by far the farthest, and also with the heaviest backpack and the most gear.
I did a hike recently where it was just about, you know, five and a half miles to my campsite, but it was a primitive campsite, so the only way to the campsite was you had to walk there. You can't reach it by car, by boat. There's a lake around this area, you know, so the only way to get to where I was camping for the night was a 5.5 mile walk, which took about four hours. But again, with all of the stuff that you have on, you know, it was in February, so over here, you know, the nights got down into like the 20 degree Fahrenheit range, 20 to 30 degree Fahrenheit, so it was cold.
Yes.
So I'm carrying you know, sleeping bags and gear that is for cold weather. So I think all total it was about, you know, 45 pounds worth of gear. And that was just the bare essentials, you know, stuff to keep me warm, a tent, some water to stay hydrated, and some food, you know, to cook or to snack on or whatever. And it does, boy, like, you know, 4 or 5 miles, you know, like I say, it was 5.5 to get there and then 5.5 the next day to leave. But just to get there that day, when you reach the end and you're ready to like camp for the night, you're like wore out.
I agree. The first days are the roughest, and it's and the amount of stuff that you have to bring is ridiculous if you want to be self-sufficient. Like, you're carrying like a third of your weight on your back.
Right, which doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're walking that distance, it gets heavier the longer you go, for sure.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's. Yep.
So aside from being a pilgrim in a way to travel this path and visit this very important religious site or holy site, if you want to call it that, you also have a bit of or an extensive academic background. You mentioned earlier you have a bachelor's, I think, and a master's in.
I started out with studying religious education. And that is, I also have a bachelor in as a teacher in computer science, and that's what I do mostly now. But at that time, I was mostly a teacher of religious education. So that's the 12 to 18 year olds. That's not exactly high school, but around that age, and then teaching philosophy and religion, and then I felt that I had to keep upgrading my knowledge. So I also started a master's at the university for interreligious spirituality, which is, more baggage than I really needed for a high school. But I found it very interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I bet. And you being a pagan yourself, that tends to be a niche or a focused area of religiosity. You, on the other hand, instead of taking that very focused approach, decided to expand your knowledge and wisdom understanding of broader scale religion, right? Just religion and philosophy in general.
Yeah, I find it very fascinating to see how different cultures and different people use their, how their faiths work, what they believe, and how they use it as a roadmap in their daily life. Like, I find it interesting to see the comparisons, but also the big differences between the different philosophies and the different mm-hmm. religions.
Yeah, I was raised Christian. I stopped going to church in like my early 20s for a short period of time, because I was at a point in my life where I wasn't really believing in these things that Christianity was teaching me anymore. I was kind of at a point in my life where I was like, I need to find something that speaks to me. Heathenry turned out to be that thing. I've gone to many, church services. I've even gone to multiple Catholic masses, in different Christian denomination services. I've been to Baptist, I've been to Pentecostals, I've been to Methodist, so many different ones. And there's, like you say, there's some like nuance to it all. You can see that there's, differences in many ways, but also this kind of ultimate truth or ultimate similarity that they all share in a lot of ways.
Yeah, exactly. They're all looking, they're looking for a similar thing, but they are trying to find it in a way that fits who they are. And mm-hmm. I feel that it's important that you can find, what you did, that you can find a way to, engage with spirituality, to engage with the world in a way that makes sense to you, that speaks to you, while still being able to understand that might not be the way that speaks to everybody. Because, otherwise you get some dogmatism for like mine is the one true, and that's
yeah it's got to be true to you, what find your truth. So when did the study of the runes come into play for you? You have a book called The Call of the Runes. I have a copy of it. I did a review on it my channel a while ago, and it's actually one of my favorite books on the runes that I've come across. So what led you to go down that particular path? If you don't want to talk about that, please.
I think there's two like defining moments that I remember. And one of them is my own religious education teacher. And maybe that is one of the reasons that I became a religious education teacher. I had two very good ones while I was at my high school. And the first one, he From him, I learned about Norse mythology for the first time. I hadn't heard about Norse mythology before, but that really stuck with me. Like, I can still picture the pages of that chapter. Like, I can it's a core memory, and I don't know why that formed, but it immediately called to me. And the second thing is that for a Sinterklaas, which is our Dutch Santa Claus celebration, my mom, you know, or Santa Claus, gave me a book on divination. And the book on divination had like all kinds of knickknacks in it, like a deck of cards and a pendulum and like, you know, whatever. But also a set of the 25 plastic runes, like the 24 basic runes and then the blank weird rune.
Oh, the blank
rune. Yeah. So, and that called to me of that set the most. And I, you know, spent a lot of time reading that little book. It's like 5 pages on the runes, if that, maybe 3. And I found it very interesting. Then I went to do rune readings for other people. And after a while, I found out that there's actually more books about runes. And I've been collecting those books about runes. Like, I've always found them very interesting, very good ones. I liked, maybe one of my favorites is Deanna Paxson's Taking Up the Runes. It's very good, especially if you're looking for starting a community. But for my more scholarly inclination, what I missed in those books is not necessarily something that you need in there to experience the runes, but I was very curious to where this knowledge came from. Like, each book said, okay, this rune means this. And I was very curious, why does this rune mean this? Why does everybody keep saying that? Where do they learn that? Where does it come from? I know there is no, you know, shaman sitting up in Scandinavia who's, you know, they all go to and who's telling them this. So where does it come from? And that was actually quite a difficult struggle to go through there. Like, a lot of it is not that well documented. Some things are completely fabricated, like the weird rune. It's like there is no basis for it. Somebody made it up at some point. And some references are very obscure. And I tried to hunt everything that I knew down. I tried to put a source under it. And then I tried to make, for the readers of the book, this logical connection of, look, this is what it says. We have this saga, we have this rune poem, we have this runic amulet, and therefore we think that we could say that this rune means this. And it's always an interpretation, and it's always, you know, a struggle where you engage with what you see and then try to make sense of it, because some sources that I have are like 1,000 years apart and 100 miles apart or hundreds of miles apart. And then you're like, okay, but both these tribes need roughly the same thing. So probably this is what it means. And that's what I try to present in this book. Like, this is all the information that we have. I think that that means this, but even if you don't agree with me, you would need at least know what all the information is and where you can find your own. And that was the goal of this book.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think it was very, very thoroughly put together. And I want to just congratulate you in person for that, because, again, so much of, you know, now in modern times, runes are used as a tool for divination by folks that are not just Norse pagan, you know, or Germanic heathens. They tend to get leveraged by other spiritualities, I've come to notice. And I've seen so much stuff online or just in books even that, you know, based on what I've learned, which is a lot of the stuff that you've included in your book, there's no like scholarly background to it. There's no historical stuff to it. They're just like basically just shooting from the hip, making things up and then putting it in a book and selling it. And people are buying this stuff and they're using this stuff, and I'm going, you know, or they're going online and they're taking these things that they see online and they're saying that it's fact. And I'm like, how, you know, you can have an interpretation or you can think of something that can be, I'll use the term a lot of times, if you've ever heard unverified personal gnosis, UPG, you know?
Yeah.
And that's okay. Like a lot of paganism is that it's our own personal experiences that cannot be, you know, traced back to any sort of historically based thing. That's fine. But call it as such, you know, don't try and put out, you know, the fact, like, I've just seen some wacky things and you probably have too, like, I don't know, like saying that, you know, Hagalaz was the rune for Heimdall or something. And I'm like going, where, when, how, like, show your source. Yeah. Tell me why you think that. None of the rune poems suggest that. Nothing that rune exists on, you know, other than the fact that his name starts with
the H sound,
you know?
Yeah.
But then hell, so does hell, you know, or whatever. So, like, come on. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And that's why I want to congratulate and thank you for the work that you put into this book, because, like you said, you know, you've got all the rune poems that are in existence for the runes that have a poem for it. Some of them don't.
No.
But you're also, you know, citing archaeological, you know, finds, things that have been seen on amulets or bracteates or other such things. And I think that that's really important for people that are serious, you know, about learning the runes, is it's more than just an alphabet. It's more than just the symbols and what they particularly mean. It's what do we know of where they appeared in history, right? Where they came from.
Yeah, that is also what this book is about. And I find that very interesting because, yeah, the runes have been compartmentalized online for a lot, for they are a divination tool. So you have your oracle cards, you have your tarot cards, and you have your runes. And those are the three ways that you can do divination, but that is not really the way that they were at least mostly used originally. And right. The question is, how were they experienced by the people who originally used it? And I agree with you, because I have a book and I found that funny. It's like he had a lot of, you know, things to say about the runes. And when I tried to figure out where it all came from, it came to him in a dream by Odin. And it's like, yeah, okay, that's cool. That's good. It's even nice that you put that in your book. But I would like to try and find historical evidence for what could it have meant for the people who first used it. And also, they would experience a hailstorm, harvest, cattle in a much different way than we experience those things. So it's not just what does it mean literally, what is the word that it represents, but what is the concept that it represents for, you know, people in another time. Mm-hmm. And what you said, you get a lot of, like, if you would go online and you would try to find what Teresas means, then 9 out of 10 times it means protection, because it is the rune of Thor and it is Thor's hammer, and it's all, you know, that's what you do. You want to be protected, cover your body in Teresas runes. Where in all the rune poems and in the sagas and on all the amulets, it's a very negative rune. It's a curse. It's like, if you want to curse somebody, Teresas, that's the rune to use.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
yeah. And it boggles my mind that's, you know, people aren't, I don't know if it's laziness or what, but they're not taking their, you know, they're not doing their due diligence to learn about the origins of the runes. And that's a dangerous thing if you're going to, I think, incorporate runes into your spirituality, whether you're heathen or not. I mean, it doesn't matter to me either way, but if you're going to incorporate them into your practices, then it's kind of like what it says in, you know, part of that stanza in the Havamal, right? Do you know how to paint them? Do you know how to bless them? Do you know how to send them? Do you know how to sacrifice them? Do you know how to do all of these things? That, because if you don't, you could, you know, you could be like what ended up happening in the saga of Yggdrasil Grimson, where the runes that were painted or carved on that whalebone made this girl sick.
Yeah, because they were
wrong. They were painted wrong. They were done wrong.
Yeah.
And then Egil can come in and he's the, you know, he's the Erilas, he's the rune master. He can fix it and he does. But yeah, that's like, those are examples of the what could happen if you're careless with this or not taking them seriously enough to use them in the proper manner, you know?
Yeah. And that's, it was fun. I've called a lot of, like, to get the book together. I've been in contact with a lot of museums to get their pictures and to get their interpretation. Like, does this thing even exist? I want to make sure that every artifact, every symbol that I have in there, at the very least, I have a sketch in there that I drew from a instance that I've seen. So I know it exists. I know it looks like this. And that there is a basis for this. And, you know, let's get back to it one more time. It's perfectly fine for me if you want to use runes however you want to use them. But it's a book for if you want to see or look at a very plausible way that they were used originally.
How long did it take you for from start to finish to get the book, you know, published and out there?
From starting to write it to publishing it, 6 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's you know, that's not 6 years of me sitting behind a desk writing full time, because I also had a, you know, a full time job.
Right.
Yeah, it's a lot of puzzling, a lot of research to begin with. And then what took a surprising amount of time is the fact checking, because, you know, I've, what I said, contact the museum. There's one little spriggan of information is that Edward Thorson, he writes in one of his books, and it's been copied all over the internet, that if you sit behind a yew tree on a hot day, then there is a professor from a Germanic university, he doesn't give a name, who said that that could cause hallucinogenic effects. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if he, you know, made that up or if he actually found that somewhere. And it took me weeks to actually find the professor who originally said that. And even though he wasn't saying it in his role as a professor at the time, but it was an anecdote of something that he noticed while he was working in his backyard, I could finally place that back. So it's been a struggle. And then the editing that took, you know, I would say a full extra year. Like, afterwards, I've just been on and off writing on it, and it was a mess. And mostly my wife went through it, and she was like, what the hell does this paragraph even mean? I have no idea. And then I was like, okay, I meant this. And then, you know, we worked through it until it was a coherent book.
Wow. So your wife helped you a lot then with the editing and...
Yeah, she's a native speaker. That helps. Yeah, she helped a lot with making sure that everything was readable. And right now on YouTube, yeah, you've seen it. I'm making videos about every chapter, because I had a lot of fun making the book, but I also would like this information to just be freely available. So I'm making a YouTube series in that sense. And my wife is doing a lot of the editing there as well. So she is... I just ramble into the camera for a while, and then she makes it into something coherent again.
Yeah, that's great. So a nice team effort there. Yeah. Oh, man, I love it. Yeah, so, you know, for folks that are listening and, you know, that watch this on my Patreon, you know, the link to Walter's book will be linked down there, but also the link to his YouTube channel. If you're curious and you just want to kind of get a taste of what the books are about, you know, Walter does, again, he breaks down each of the runes in their chapters to speak about, you know, the rune poems that they're cited in, any of the esoteric knowledge that we have of them, plus the historical placement of them, if they've been on any sort of, you know, device that has been discovered through archaeological means, you know, at Bracteates, such so on and so forth. So I definitely encourage you guys to check all that out too. How often do you publish them? I know you're up to like what, Perthro or something now, I think.
Yeah, once a week. I think Olgis is coming up tomorrow. Let's say I try to bring them out every Saturday. This Saturday, I haven't fully get around to it, or my wife hasn't fully got around to editing the last bit. But I should go up tomorrow. Next week, we finish the second day yet, and then 8 more weeks. And then I think I'll do one more video on how to, you know, what are bind runes, what are, you know, Loth Runner, and, you know, hidden runes, runic ciphers, and maybe one about ideas that we have about how rune magic might have been, you know, what the idea might have been structurally behind rune magic. What do you call that?
Runology, or maybe not runology.
Yeah, I'm talking about certain structures that we keep seeing back.
Elder stuff.
Yeah.
The old Icelandic word, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then maybe a short one about runic divination, because even if it's the most popular, it's from a standpoint of archaeology, I have the least to say about that, because, you know, we have Tacitus saying that maybe runes were used, possibly.
Right, possibly.
That's what we know. He mentions that a way that people cast runes and what kind of tree they cut them on, and that they used symbols. He doesn't say runes because, you know, he wouldn't know. Mm-hmm. And that's what we have. And we can assume that it's runes because they have such a rich meaning. Those are carved on the thing. So it's probable that runes were used for divination. But all the archaeological evidence that we have is like 5 lines from Tacitus.
Right. Which, that's interesting that you brought that up, because here, like, I do, I started learning runes, the Elder Futhark runes,
just
to be clear. I started to kind of dive into those studies maybe just a couple of years into my heathenry, when I first discovered heathenry and started pursuing it as a spirituality and a religious path. They weren't like the immediately first thing that I wanted to invest time or energy learning. And I personally feel that they're not for everybody. They're not necessarily like, you don't have, if you're a heathen or a pagan and you don't use runes, or you don't have an inclination to learn the runes, that's totally fine. And, you know, leave it to the people that have that interest or want to pursue it and that can learn it. It's not like a requirement. But
no, exactly.
Right. Yeah. So like when I first started, and that was almost 10 years ago now. So, but I do rune readings for people in person at certain times, you know, like if there's an event or something that I'm going to, there's a local pagan group that are very, you know, Norse Germanic in their thing. So they have 3 public events a year, and they have vendors and things that show up. And so quite often at those events, I will have a tent or a table or whatever set up for rune readings. And you mentioned Tacitus and that source being what little we know of runes possibly maybe being used as a form of divination by the Germanic tribes at the time. And that's my basis of how I read runes, is I don't spread them out like a tarot deck. I don't do anything like that. I cast them.
Yeah.
And the readings are dependent on a lot of, you know, I don't believe in the Merkstav concept of reading runes, because to me the rune is just inherently what it means is what it means regardless. It would be like, well, if you write a letter A, it's still a letter A if you write it sideways or upside down. That doesn't mean meaning of it per se. To me,
in my book, I say that because the most famous runic symbol that we know is the Helm of Awe, which is in its most basic form is 4 Alchis runes facing different directions. And if that would mean that they would, you know, be opposite meanings 4 times, then you would end up with a meaningless symbol. So I feel like it doesn't matter what way they're facing. I agree with that.
Yeah. And I've told people, you know, when you get readings from someone who's reading runes, right, my methodology behind it is probably not going to be exactly the same as another person's. The runes, we learn different things from them as readers, as Vitki, as the rune masters, right? As we learn them, they speak to us and we speak to them. So there's and this is very much UPG, guys, so for just take that into consideration. I feel that while there are meanings behind the rune symbols, and there are, you know, rune poems that tell us what they are, perhaps, or there's other symbols that appear on other things that we know that's what it was meant to be or probably meant to mean. There's still very much a relationship that's happening between the readers of the runes and the persons getting the reading. there's this sort of exchange that's taking place. And there's, you know, again, my UPG is that, you know, not every reader is going to read runes the same way for that reason.
And not even the same spread. I would fully agree with you. The main way that I like to read the runes is also by casting the runes. And then I take away the runes that are facing down because I can't read those. So those I take away. And then I try to see the relationship between, like, if two runes are touching each other, very close to each other. That is, but that is in no way can I say this is a hard science. And if it falls, you know, if you measure the angles exactly like this, then you know exactly what these runes means. This is my interpretation. And I feel that you're right. It's a conversation between you, the person you're giving the reading to, and the runes. They are the person who you're giving the reading to gives context, the runes give context, and you try to make a
sense of it. Yeah.
Try to tell the story. You try to tell the story that is in the runes that relates to the question that's being asked.
Yeah. No, I like that. You know, you mentioned the casting method, and then that the runes that are face down, that when they land that way, they're not read because they're not, you can't see them. I've heard other people that have background with runes and reading runes say something similar. My approach is slightly different in that I don't necessarily read the runes right there and then and there. They become part of the reading throughout the experience because I look at it as, well, something's being concealed, something's hidden. That we need to maybe peel a layer back and explore and try to figure out or understand, you know, like it may not be a part of the immediate thing, but it's a part of the big picture sort of thing. And maybe this is a, you know, a layer that's just hiding behind the curtain or something, you know, that again, my personal layer of divination that I throw in there. So it's worked for me and it's worked for the people I've done it for, which, by the way, I personally only do readings in person. Like I can't get the same experience out of it for the person if I'm doing it like this or online or anything like that. Like, I personally have to be face to face with you in real time, in real space to do it. Like,
no, I agree with that. I'm not saying that I've never done a rune reading for somebody online, but generally speaking, if I do a rune reading for somebody, it's somebody who I'm sitting across from. Like sometimes somebody asks, and if I know them well, then I'm willing to do it online. But generally speaking, that's not how I do it. But there is no. We can use a white cloth. That's what we know. And we can use wooden runes. I use stone runes, so that's already not exactly how it's written. And it's a story. It's a way that we use the runes as a map to get their meaning. And I understand your way where you're saying, hey, the runes that are turned it around are not yet revealed to us, but we can see what is coming. Like, that's the part that's hidden. And that seems like a very clear way of interpreting that as well, instead of what I do. And I just, you know, pluck them out.
I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, again, this is all like, you know, what do we have to know about if how the runes were used by the Germanic tribes or by this Norse, you know, Scandinavian people. It's a lot of it's just we're making this we're trying to make sense of what information we have available. Obviously, you know, this, you spent many years reading, you know, studying and finding information. So what we come up with in a reconstructive sort of way, it's, you know, if it works, it works. You know, maybe it's slightly different from person to person. I also like to think of, when we speak of runes, right, the etymology of that word, and that it is a mystery, or they are mysteries, right?
Exactly.
Anything particular about that you'd like to add to with as much work as you've done?
I think that's and I start, especially for us now, the runes are a mystery, because so much of the knowledge of what they might have meant is lost. I think it's also very apt to think of where the runes come from, mythologically speaking. They don't come from this world. Odin plucked them from another world. And I also think that's very fitting because of their symbolic nature. A rune does not have a... if we look at the rune poems, at least, it doesn't have a singular meaning. It's not just cattle, feu. Feu is cattle. But it is wealth, and it is gold, and it is the warning of hoarding too much money. And it's a very complex web of meaning. And in that case, in that way, it is a mystery. It's a whole world hidden behind a single symbol.
Yeah, because it makes it that much more of a complex experience when reading the runes, because it's not like we're just looking at a singular symbol and going, well, based on that symbol, we're going to read it a certain way, right? The Fey rune and the Hagalaz rune and the Naudi's rune might appear in a reading. All of those things combined could mean so many different things. It could mean, a storm is brewing and you need to protect your wealth. It could mean that the wealth that you have is going to experience turmoil and you need, there was a need to, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's so many ways to, so the context is important. And that's why I feel like the runes as themselves being this just inherent mystery, it is a lifelong study of not just what the symbols mean through like the rune poems or whatnot, but getting through that experience and experiencing the mysteries of them through working with them.
Yeah, exactly. And even a single rune, if I were to ask, how will my business venture go? And somebody, I would draw a fail. I would generally say, okay, your business venture is going to go well. This is wealth. And if somebody would say, what's the biggest problem that I'm going to run on into my life? And it's also feu, then I'm not saying your biggest problem in your life is that you're too wealthy. The meaning is very dependent there on the person and the question that's being asked. So yeah, it is it's a mystery, and that's interpretation part is where what you say. There's a lot of personal gnosis in there, and that cannot be quantified.
Yeah. Yeah, and I love to see what people come up with in their own, I love hearing people's UPG, as long as we're clear with what that is, and, that giving that sort of a disclaimer about it, because we're in a time of our lives, as a society, as a people, we're all looking for answers to things, people, I think, are just generally more inquisitive, and they're wanting to either be given answers, or given sources to find answers. So, I mean, people are going to believe a lot of times in many ways, in many cases, they're going to believe what they're told.
Yeah.
And it lays a heavy burden of responsibility on folks that are publishing work like yourself, and even people like me who are putting out content, to always be cognizant and aware, back it up with what you're saying with either your sources, or if there's no source for it, then be like, this is what we know already. Like, kind of let you, what you've done throughout is explain, this is what we know so far. This is my interpretation, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I find that very important. That's a good chunk of my introduction. It's like, hey, I'm going to talk in the rest of this book about this, but to keep in mind, this is always my interpretation, but it's too cumbersome to author every line and say, I think. So it's, it's very important.
What, I think. What else is also, what I, what else, I, excuse me, what I also find interesting is the, it's always the Elder Futh arc, right? That people want to look at, you look online, Nordic runes or something. It's always the Elder Futh arc.
That's very interesting.
There's no rune poem for the Elder Futh arc runes. Essentially, there's rune poems for the Anglo-Saxon runes, of which some appear in, we see in the Elder Futh arc runic system. But then, you know, like the Norwegian and Icelandic rune poems are runes that we see in the younger Futhark system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's always the Elder Futhark, even though we know the least about the Elder Futhark, particularly. Like, it's very interesting. It's how it is, because the Futhark has more runes, so why not, like, why not go there, have some extra information, and nobody does it, and neither did I also went for the Elder Futhark, and I think that is just a convention, but you are 100% right, it's a weird convention. I understand why people wouldn't go for, you know, the younger Futhark, because, you know, you lose a few runes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why not work with the full set of 24? But in that logic, why not work with the Futhark and you know, gain an extra set? So it's a very good question. An industry thing.
Oh yeah, no, it is. It's something that I think about constantly, and it's, you know, do you know, because sure, you know, the name of it might be Feu in Elder Futhark, but then it's Fe in the younger. Same with Ulrus, right? It's their Proto-Germanic names, but they changed and they evolved over time as the runic systems did. You know, they don't
change
meanings per se. However, in some of the rune poems, like, I find interesting, like the I think the Anglo-Saxon Futhork rune for the Caun rune, Canas.
Yeah,
Canas, right? Like, in the rest of the rune poems, that rune poem mentions that it is a like an ulcer.
Yeah,
and then the Futhork, the Anglo-Saxon Futhork rune poem mentions that it's a torch.
Yeah, that's one of the most. It's one could say that it's both heat and fever, and we can, you know, talk about that. But that is the most tricky one. But you see the same thing for Thrisas, where Thrisas in the Norwegian and the Icelandic rune poem is a troll,
right?
And then it's a thorn in Anglo-Saxon. And, you know, you can say, because the rune poem about the Anglo-Saxon one is about, you know, grasping a thorn, and it's also harmful, and having trolls in your life is also harmful, so it's on the same theme. But
yeah,
you know, the one you bring up, Canas, the ulcer and the torch, is the most, for me at least, one of the more confusing ones, because I would like to believe that there is a theme that both bring back, but you know, in my book I try to say, like, okay, we can see that there's maybe, you know, there's funeral pyres, there's, like, we can see some connections to maybe where, how the leap went from being an ulcer to a torch, in the same way that we might see how there's a leap from a troll to a thorn, or, you know, from an elk to a swan, in those things. Yeah, the Anglo-Saxon rune poems are much different than the Norwegian and the Icelandic rune poems.
Yeah.
And I'm also always very curious about how many rune poems might there have been?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have three, and all three, if you go a little bit into the history, like, it's like two or three times in their lives, it's like, okay, a person had them, and then they, you know, copied them, and then 3 weeks later, the original burned away, and then it was only the copy that we still had, and then I went to a library, and the library just made a copy, and then the library burned down, and then it's like, so many things could have gone wrong, like, and it would have never reached us now, and we'd have never read the Icelandic or the Norwegian or the Anglo-Saxon rune poem, that you can only imagine that there probably were more versions of the rune poems that we just, you know, are just lost because the library that they were in was burned down, or, you know, the monk that was in charge of that was just not careful, and, you know.
I've also been exposed to somebody who is, I mean, he's still alive, but he's of Icelandic descent. He was born here in America, but he remembers being around, like, I think it was his great grandfather who was from Iceland. And he remembers being taught by his great-great-grandfather a method of reading runes that was very specific that I have not seen anywhere else. And I'm not at liberty to share the details of those things because it is a family tradition. Yeah. But I thought it's worth mentioning that there is likely more of that that exists than we realize. Because who would get exposed to something like that and have the chance to speak about it? You have these family traditions, these specific ways that a family would use runes to read. Because I think even Tacitus mentions that how the Germanic tribes did it when it came time for the thing to be read, for the lots to be cast. It was done by either like the priest, or if it was a family, it was done by the father. The head of the house, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
There was that tradition there too that we don't really hear a whole lot of, but that backs it up. Here's this person from Iceland who had a system that was very unique to them, and I wouldn't expect anybody else to use it unless it was that person's family or somebody that person's family trusted to share in that knowledge with.
No, exactly, because that's interesting because, yeah, Tacitus sort of describes it going through the paternal line, where in a lot of the other sagas, we see it mostly, like if we have it talking about divination, it's mostly the maternal line. Like it's doing that.
It's like women's work.
it's interesting. But you're right. It must. I also feel it's alive because, you know, in your background, you have the Vegasvir, the runic compass.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, every time you put that on somewhere, somebody's going to say, ah, yeah, but that's from the 18th century, so that's not really... That's true. It's a later symbol, but it's from a period of time where apparently this tradition was still going. Like, surely it has evolved, and surely, you know, things are going on. But it's not like just somebody who's reinventing from nothing. Like it's been going for a very long time, and only for like a few hundred years now, like it seems like we have lost everything. But in Iceland, there's plenty of magical manuscripts, sometimes written by priests even, that contain runes or call upon Odin, or like it's been in the nitty gritty. It's in the between lines in the Scandinavian countries. It's just been alive in the small places.
Yeah, absolutely. They've kept that tradition alive, like you say, you know, and maybe it was revived or it got more exposure at that period of time and became more popular through, you know, whatever means. But yeah, I've had so many people make a comment about this. Oh, you do realize? Yes, I realize that, first of all. Secondly, it was a gift. Like a friend of mine gave this to me back when I first started my channel, and it's been a staple. It's always been here for as long as I've been doing content. So I'm like, it's our tradition, right? It's the tradition here on the channel, the podcast, right? Like, so get over it. It's here, it's staying. Just, you know, you don't like it, then I guess I don't know what to tell you. But yeah. What do you have you ever thought of, or do you have an opinion on people with whether it's academic backgrounds or invested interest to explore modern contemporary runic systems? For instance, I know of somebody who recently developed, and I don't know how long it took them to develop this, but I know that it was a long time. Like, it wasn't just something that they came up with overnight. An American futhark, for the reason of writing in like modern English, let's say, you know, because one of the big things that happens nowadays is people are using elder futhark runes to write modern English words. Yeah. And there's so many opinions around this. It's, you know, you can't do that because, first of all, those runes were used to write in a Proto-Germanic language that predates the Old Norse language. You first have to translate the word that you're trying to say in English into an Old Norse word, and then, you know, whatever. And then you technically should be using the younger futhark instead of the elder, because they're the runes that were used to write in Old Norse, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sure you've heard.
Yeah.
So what do you think about people coming up with a contemporary system of American or whatever modern day futhark runes for the purpose of not just writing modern languages in, but also to explore their maybe magical or esoteric properties.
I personally have no problem with that. And the reason for that is that if you look, we have the Elder Fruit Arc. And the Elder Fruit Arc is not the only Fruit Arc that has been used. That was used for 200 years. And then somebody said, that's not really what we want anymore. We're cutting some, this is an oversimplification, but slowly the system of the Elder Fruit Arc, you know, grew out. We lost a few runes and we had the Younger Fruit Arc system. And then after a while, Latin came and people were like, we also want to write these Latin words and we don't have the sounds for it. So we're just going to add some new runes to it again. So historically speaking, there's precedent for changing your runic alphabet to fit the needs that you have as a society at that time. And if we look at the inscriptions that we have, it's also sometimes a hodgepodge of a little bit of Latin and a little bit of Norse and a little bit of, you know, it's not like the runes were only used to write in one language and only one language. They were used, especially at least the Futhark and the Younger Futhark, they were used to write several languages. And then also people used wildly different grammars, and some things that we think are maybe random, maybe they have a grammatical reason, but most bind runes just seem to be because there was not enough space left on the page or on the piece of stone. And then it's like, smoosh. And now right. It's, you know, two runes is one rune. So I don't think that the people who originally used the runes were too bothered about what runic alphabet you were using and if you're writing in the right language and if you were using exactly the right formula. So I don't think we should be either.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. I feel like we've probably just advanced as a species, but you know, we've become just much more intellectually advanced. Not saying people were always stupid, but you know what I mean. You know, like there's more going on up here in this space now for people nowadays. I think it's a bit more of a complex world than it was in the past. So I think maybe people tend to just nitpick at things more than are worth being nitpicked at. And I have to admit, you know, like if I see somebody writing a symbol or writing a sentence, or not even a sentence, but a phrase or a word, and they're trying to like use like Elder Futhark for it. For a period of time there, I was like, no, you know, you don't use the double rune. Like if you want to say will, you're not going to use a Winyo, an Isa, and two Lagus runes.
No,
you're just not going to do that, you know? And I don't know, like there's still that part of me that wants to, if I see something like that, be like, no, don't do that. And then there's also a part of me like,
yeah,
you know, whatever, I guess like we're really beating a dead horse here at this point, but I'm just curious how, if this newer contemporary system would help, correct those type of errors, you know.
I'm fully on your page there because it's I wrote a book about the Elder Futhark, and that is, you know, there is some traditionalist, you know, sentiment in there which is not logical or academical, and if I see somebody what you say spell will with a double Lochas rune, even though I know that there's also examples where double, you know, rare examples, but examples where original texts were written with a double, the same rune, it does exist. It has happened. So intellectually, I feel that an American rune system is perfectly fine. And I would be very interested into, you know, understanding how it works and how it comes to pass, and maybe it is technically even better because we have different concepts that are ingrained to us than you know, old Nordic people had. Like there's a lot of talk about fire and ice and cold winters. It's like, yeah, like I'm cold winters, I know that snow exists and it's very, you know, traffic is bad, it snows real hard, but that's right. About the extent of my cold winter. So in that regard, those symbols directly don't mean the same thing for me. So maybe it's more logical to make a new system which has symbols that symbolize or current maps of meaning. But on the other hand, oh, it feels so nice to go back and be like, traditionally for the, you know. And I think that's something that all people have. You always want to call back to something like, yes, the good old days. Then that is the original. That's what we want. Yeah. And that's not a logical twinge, but it's a twinge that we all have. It's like, we want to know how the runes, the old runes worked.
Yeah, nostalgia. Yeah, no, I think that that is also a valid observation, because when we talk about, like you say, the good old days, or, you know, the, you know, reminiscing, remembering a period of time where we feel it was simpler, it was less hassle, it was more, you know, as you know, healthful lifestyles should be. You know, there's not all these bills and technology and all this other nonsense that exists now in modern times. I think maybe some of the pushback that could come from thinking of a contemporary runic system being created, American Futhark, if we call it that, or as it's called, I think that some of the pushback is coming from, like, you're messing with tradition, you know, you're taking away from these old times and these old ways. And I think, you know, I don't think so. I don't think that that's the purpose behind what we're talking about is. I think you brought up a good point that we're finding perhaps things that are relative to us in our time and you know, evolving or shifting a bit in our spirituality, right? So if we're using the runes, that we're, you know, we're really not seeing how, like you say, you know, those ancient people understood what it meant to have fire. You know, like, that was, you didn't have fire, you didn't have warmth, you didn't have light. Well, we've got all of those things out. You know, now, without the need of creating fire.
Yeah.
So again, like, there's that traditionalist, you know, old fashioned kind of look on things and wanting to preserve the sanctity of those old systems, those old ways. And maybe what's happening is they feel like, oh, you know, you're coming up with all this new stuff and it's pushing out those old ways. And I don't think, again, that that's the purpose behind it, or that's what it's doing, but I can see why some of the pushback would happen if that's what they're thinking it's doing.
Yeah, I think we, you know, circling back a little bit to what we were talking about in the beginning, it's fine to have your own, you know, personal gnosis and to create things, as long as it's clear where things come from. Like, if you can explain where you're coming from, how you've changed things, that's, you know, perfectly fine. You are trying to progress the evolution of the runes. And if it's a very good system, it'll stick, because that is also how all the other systems started. Like, somebody at some point made a divergent, and, you know, people were probably right, like, that's dumb. Well, what are you doing? And then one system is better or more suited to the time, and that sticks. There's probably been other systems that have been, like, flared up regionally for a second and then, you know, die down again. So only with hindsight can we see what was culturally valuable and what wasn't. And we should try to remember what we have without being like, but only what we had was good, and fully romanticizing what we had.
Well, languages do that anyway. I'm sure you've seen too. I mean, like, you know, you go down the line of where we are. We'll just say modern English. You know, well, you know, there was Old English, and while that's its own language, it's a Germanic language. And then you look at the progression of the Germanic language over time. You know, you had your Low German, your Middle High German, your High German, your current, you know, the language that is spoken now, modern German. You know, like, Old Saxon, you know, I mean, like, how things progress over time, people change, people relocate, you know, things aren't just stagnant, and there's not this stasis where people are staying put. So I think that that's also something to consider. It's all about progression and movement. And so some people don't like that. Some people just don't like being progressive.
No, exactly. It's difficult, because being progressive gives a certain certainty. and it's been part of the runic debate for a long time. Higgs, who was one of the person who copied or had copied the rune poems in England from before the Cotton Library burned down, was part of a big debate in England between the ancients and the moderns, who were trying to figure out if they could distill the true English language by cutting out all the Germanic origins of it. And Higgs was like, that is, you know, that's dumb. You can't, because, but they were like, no, there is a, you know, divine English language, and we have to try and find this once and perfect language. But that's not how language works. Language is a, right, is a web of meaning that's continually changing and evolving.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you go back far enough, if you know how far down the rabbit hole do you want to go? There's words now that exist that have origins in Proto-Indo-European words. That's a long time ago, man. Like, you want to talk about getting rid of certain words in a language? Well, then you're gonna have to go back, you know, a few millennia at least.
Yeah, exactly. The Hindu word. And I might not be remembering this correctly, but this is how it was taught to me when I was in university in the Hinduism lessons. The word Veda, which is their book, means to know. And the Dutch word Weten, also meaning to know, comes from the same Indo root, proto, very, very far away, all the way here, or word now in the Netherlands and in India, you know, devolved from the same word, but it's a completely different branch of the path that English took, because, you know, even though, it splits, and you can see that as well, because in English, the word fee means money, and in Dutch, the word fee means cattle, both meanings of the feo rune, both coming from the same stem, but in the end meaning something completely different, because we just, you know, took a different side branch of the language tree.
Yeah. There's still that root that's there, though, that you can trace it back to. Yeah. This is fascinating, man. Do you have anything else coming? Like, I know you've had your book out now for, I forget how long exactly. I've had a copy of it for, I don't know, about a year maybe now or more, but anything else?
It came out a bit over a year ago. I'm pondering a little bit. I'm now doing the YouTube series, and it'll take a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. There's two themes that I would like to write about. One of them is I would like to write a sort of encyclopedia. Encyclopedia? Yes, the English word is encyclopedia. Yeah. Of Nordic mythology. So just go into what are the places, what are the, you know, which are the gods, what creatures, what do we come and what sagas do we find them in, you know, what names did Odin have, why do they have these names? Just like so that if you want to know more about a specific subject, you can just deep dive. Another thing that I would be very interested in writing about is writing about a contrast between modern day, I'm going to say Asturu, but modern day Northern paganism as a white, what rituals exist? What do people do? How do people connect with the gods? You know, what's happening? With also maybe not contrasting, but also including what archaeological evidence we have about how Old Norse people did their tradition, so that you sort of have a overview of tradition from the earliest that we know until how it presents itself these days.
That'd be awesome, man. I know there's a lot of ritual practices or things that exist now in the day that are very modern, that have, you know, but they, you know, where did the idea come from? One of the recent, like, I had a post, or not a post on my page, but like I recently saw somebody post something on social media about the hammer, the sign of the hammer, and how much it looks like the sign of the crucifix, you know, creating the sign of the cross, I should say, that the Catholics do, and how you know, creating the sign of the hammer is, oh, it's a Christian thing. And we're like, well, in the saga of Håkon the Good, where we hear about it being done, it was done by the king to bless a cup or a horn or something. But it says in the saga that, you know, his retainer had already made a blessing in the name of Odin. And then when the king did it, he quote unquote made the sign of the cross. Well, people were like, what is that? What are you doing? And his retainer had to kind of quickly think and go, well, what he's actually doing, he's blessing this in Thor's name, and he's making his hammer. He's making the sign of the hammer, you know? Now, Håkon, yes, he was a Christian king, but he wasn't always, you know? So it makes you wonder, like, well, where did that, was that definitely a 100% Christian thing, or was there something maybe that dated back to
the older times?
Older times that, you know, because we know that the symbol of Mjolnir has evolved and changed over time, but it's always been that very long bottom, short top, shorthanded symbol from early archaeological finds. So to do that, to make that symbol, may not necessarily be too far-fetched to think of it having existed prior to the Christianity spread in the north. So
yeah, exactly. So that would be very fascinating to me, because we have some archaeological evidence and some sagas that offerings were made to Suthur, to giants. That's something that we don't really say anymore. And just modern day Norse paganism also has a very wide range that would be very interesting. Those will all be probably multi-year projects again to get everything on board. And until that time, I'm gonna at least finish my series on YouTube, so everybody can find those. My book will stay available. And every now if I think of something interesting, I'll keep posting that on my Facebook and my Instagram
you have your Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. And so for everybody that's, you know, listened to this episode today or is watching this, you know, which however you're catching this, all of that information is going to be linked in the either description of the video or the show notes of the podcast. So for you folks on Patreon that are watching this, it'll be down in the description. For everybody else listening, check the show notes for Walter's Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, as well as the link to purchase his book, The Call of the Runes, on Amazon. So all that will be down for you.
Oh, that would be that'll be great. I hope that more people can be informed and entertained.
I do too, man. I really appreciate the work and effort that you put into it. It was really nice to get a chance to talk with you today and learn a bit more about you. I mean, hearing you talk about that pilgrimage to Spain was fascinating. So you're definitely a really interesting individual. And it's great to get to know you a little bit more in that level. So yeah, anything else that you wanted to add or say before we wrap this up?
Well, just want to thank you for the opportunity to have this talk. It's, I think, a very good talk. I enjoyed it a lot. And so thank you very much for allowing me to be on your podcast.
Oh, yeah, sure. That was absolutely my pleasure. I'm glad we got a chance to do it. Even though the time zone change makes for a challenge sometimes, we made it happen. Don't go anywhere real quick. When I wrap things up, we'll touch base offline so I can give you clear expectations of when this episode airs. So don't go anywhere. But for everybody else that is listening and watching to this today, hope you enjoyed it. If you did, show your support in any way that you can. My information is in the Linktree link. That's in the show notes or down there in the description. Follow me on all my socials. You can buy merchandise, become a patron on Patreon if you want to watch these video versions of the podcast. It does help with all the future productions of this show. And check out all of Walter's stuff that you find down here or over there as well. Show your support in any way that you can. So until we talk to each other again, may the gods continue to notice you, and may your ancestors smile upon you. We'll see you in the next one.